steel and concrete cell in a small Georgia town. She goes through the surveillance tape two more times. Yawns. Something is still wrong. Again, she goes back to the beginning and sees the big pickup truck roll in, and the owner, Vihan Lagari, sitting on a metal stool, smoking a cigarette, watching the television set underneath the counter. When the door opens up, Lagari stubs out the cigarette, stands up, and she rewinds the video. Watches. Rewinds the video. Even in the poor black and white quality of the video, she can make out what Lagari is watching on the hidden television. It's not a Bollywood program. It's one of those reality housewives shows on the Bravo network. Damn, she whispers. She opens a browser window, gets to work, and there's a pounding on the door that goes on and on and on. York instantly slaps the cover down on her laptop, getting rid of a light source. Then she rolls over onto the floor and thrusts her right hand into her open go bag. On the other side of the room, Pierce wakes up and says, "What the hell is going on?" The pounding is heavy, hard, determined. "Keep your voice down," she says to the JAG lawyer. "Somebody either wants in or wants our attention." She slides along the wall, Sig Sauer in hand, and she quietly unbolts the chain to the door. There's a peephole in the door, but there's no way she's putting an unguarded eye up to it. Too many memories of horror movies with ice picks driving through the peephole into dumb victims, which she most certainly is not. York grabs the doorknob, gives it a good spin, and quickly pulls the door open. Outside, an angry-looking Major Cook is there, metal cane in hand, dressed in gym shorts and a gray and blue NYPD t-shirt, and he says, "Choir practice, now." He limps off to room 11, and after grabbing her laptop, she follows him, with Pierce right behind her, yawning and scratching at his head. Pierce says, "Mind telling me what choir practice means?" The laptop is warm under her arm. "Old cop slang. An after-hours meeting, unofficial, no records kept. Usually it means an after-shift party, or an ass-kicking. Care to guess what we're in for?" "No," Pierce says. Inside room 11, it's warm and stuffy, and it smells of sweat and old grease, just like her own room with Pierce. If there's housekeeping at this motel, Connie has yet to see it. Huang and Sanchez are there, sitting next to each other, wearing shorts and t-shirts. Sanchez has a number of tattoos on his large upper biceps. The major waits until everyone is seated and then slams the door shut. Nobody says a word. Everyone is paying attention. Cook's face is mottled red, and York thinks this is the first time she and the others have seen his wounded leg. She's shocked at how pale and thin it is, and how the flesh is puckered and ridged with scars and burn tissue. The pain her boss goes through every day must be tremendous. He says, "Listen up, look around. This is a special unit, coordinated by the Criminal Investigation Division of the goddamn United States Army, tasked to investigate crimes of high interest and severity. That means Colonel Phillips and myself thought at one point you had the experience and guts to get the job done." York's computer is on her lap, and she's slowly manipulating the keys, wanting to take a closer look at what the new browser window is revealing. Cook leans into his cane, and she thinks he's standing here, leg exposed, to shock all of them, and the major's doing a good job. Even though she's quietly working on something else, his words shoot out at them like chunks of cold stone. "Right now, damn it, you're failing. All of you. You've done some preliminary work gathering information and evidence, but you know what? It's all been fed to us, all of it. The police reports, the witnesses, the surveillance tape, the forensics, the county coroner. Everything has been set up on the proverbial goddamn silver platter, and right now it stops." York freezes the browser. "My God. Can this be true?" Cook nearly shouts, "Sanchez!" He sits up. "Sir, Wendy Gabriel, the witness who has the dog. Find her, or find someone who knows why she's gone or where she's gone. You hit every mobile home and shack within 5 miles of that place. You go back to her home and you look it over, see if there's anything there that says why she left and where she went. Sir, she's a hoarder, and I don't care if she collects her dog's urine in mason jars. You get back into that house and find something. Pierce." "Sir," Pierce says. York slowly moves her fingers, the digits feeling fat and clumsy, because she can't believe what she's just found. Pierce, you get your ass back to the Ralston jail. Do whatever you have to do to talk to the Rangers. Why in hell are they planning to defend themselves without outside counsel? Are they being pressured? Blackmailed? And when you go to Ralston, you take Huang with you. Huang says in a tired voice. But sir, I mean...
Doctor, shut up and do your job, Cook says, his face even more red. You suck it up and get back to Ralston and you do your damn professional best and get in there and talk to those Rangers. What happened to them in Afghanistan with that civilian house they supposedly hit? What rivalries and jealousies do other members of their battalion have against them? What do they think drove Tyler to kill himself?
York is staring at her computer screen, hoping she's right, hoping she's...
Agent York! Cook yells. What the hell is so goddamn important on your goddamn computer? Have you listened to a goddamn word I've said?
Sir, I... A phone rings. York feels warm and ashamed, like a high school student caught cheating on a test. Everyone looks around the room to see which one of them has interrupted the major, until he curses, reaches into his shorts, pulls out his phone. He glances at the screen. Colonel Phillips, Cook says.
Good, let's see what he's found out about our Rangers and the CIA.
The major brings his phone up and says,
Cook here. Sir, could I...
Oh. Then, amazingly and frighteningly, his red face drains of all color, becoming pasty white. Something is wrong, York thinks. Cook says,
But sir...
No. Something is very seriously wrong. Chapter 41. My left leg feels like the femur inside is a piece of old wood blazing with white hot heat, and I do my very best to ignore the pain when I say, I'm sorry, sir, could you say that again? Even though the caller ID said Philip CID Quantico, it's not our commanding officer speaking to me. It's his deputy, Lieutenant Colonel Broderick, and he says,
Colonel Phillips is in the hospital. We're not sure how long he's going to be there, or when, or if he's getting out.
Can I ask what's wrong, sir?
No, Broderick says. I've been placed in command. Major, how long before you can wrap it up and report back to Quantico? I find for a moment that I've lost my voice. The pain is rippling up and down my leg like an inferno that just goes on and on. My crew are all staring at me in their shorts and t-shirts, sitting in this warm and pungent motel room in rural Georgia.
Colonel, I'm sorry.
Come back to Quantico? I ask.
That's right, he says. I'm shutting you down, all of you. Pack your bags, pay your bills, and get back to Quantico. When you get here, you're going to write up a summary on how you dicked everything up down there, and then it's over.
Sir, we're right in the middle of- Major, you're in the middle of one of the biggest domestic army screw-ups since we spied on demonstrators back in the 60s. Since your alleged investigation has started, you've pissed off the locals, gone places where you shouldn't have gone, insulted elected officials, and, oh yeah, you went down there with four Army Rangers in custody. Now one's dead because your idiot doctor pushed him to kill himself.
I can't believe what I'm hearing, and I say, Colonel, that is way out of line, sir, and-
Broderick says, you don't get it, do you? Not only is this investigation over, you and your unit are over. Paperwork is being drawn up right now to disband it. Your lawyer is going back to JAG to defend enlisted men stealing MREs. The doc is going to be investigated for malpractice, and your two other CID investigators are also going to face disciplinary hearings. As for you, Major, I think a quiet request to retire will be looked upon favorably.
I clench my hands, a fist on my cane, a fist holding my phone. Our job isn't completed, sir. There's a lot to be done.
And it's going to be done, as it should have been, by the book, by the locals, Broderick says. Those Rangers committed their crimes off post. Face it, Jeremiah, your unit was an experiment, and most experiments fail. I expect to hear about your travel plans by noon today.
He disconnects the call. I slowly lower my hand. Expectant faces look up at me, their boss, their major, their leader, waiting for me to say something, waiting for me to make it all right. What I've heard from Colonel Broderick is ricocheting around in my mind, but I need to get us out of this room.
Outside, I sharply say. Now.
I open the door and limp out into the darkness. The air is thick, hot, and warm. It's like I can't remember ever being cool. I stop at the front end of our battered Ford and my crew gather round. Their faces and attitudes are barely visible in the parking lot lights. Fortunately for us, it seems like the ravens from the news media are finally sleeping.
Face in, I say. Huddle up. I see Connie has her laptop firmly under her arm, and I feel a shot of anger, but let it slide for now. That was Lieutenant Colonel Broderick, I say. Colonel Phillips is in the hospital. Broderick has taken over. He called to say he's shutting us down. Period, end of discussion, and probably the end of our respective careers. Almost as one, my four team members seem to take a small step back, as if in shock. I say, I've been told to submit my retirement papers, and all of you are facing disciplinary hearings and probable punishment or reduction in rank. None of your futures look bright, I'm sorry to say. Sanchez says, this is bullshit, Major. Pierce says, high quality bullshit, sir. Whatever it is, Broderick wants our travel arrangements made by noon today. There won't be a debriefing or hearing on what we found. I'm to write a report in Quantico, which will be buried, and the rest of you are to go home. Now, we have some things to discuss. York puts her laptop on the hood of one of the Fords. Sir, if I may, I lose it.
For God's sake, York, put that damn thing away!
Even in the dim light, I can see anger flare across her face. No, sir, I won't do that. Not on your life. Look at this and look at it now, Major.
Agent York, you're about to— Damn it, Jeremiah, listen to me!
My anger is sliding right up there. But a rational part of me knows something is driving my ex-Virginia state trooper, and I keep my mouth shut. She taps a key on the laptop, and a familiar video pops up. The surveillance video stream from the convenience store.
The store surveillance video, she says. It's a fake.
Chapter 42. Special Agent Connie York is feeling a lot of emotions right at this moment, but the one that secretly pleases her the most is knowing that all these strong and capable men, including Cook and especially Sanchez, who likes to whip out his LAPD background at every opportunity, are giving her 100% of their attention. Pierce stares at the screen.
Fake? It looks pretty real to me, Connie.
The Rangers are real, the store owner is real, but this... And she taps the lower right corner of the screen. This timestamp, it's fake. You see what it says? It says 7:40 p.m., presumably about 10 minutes before the killing started, 20 minutes before they were seen leaving the summer house.
They are all staring at the white numerals, and Sanchez says, sorry, I don't see it.
That's right, York says, an edge of triumph in her voice. Because you're missing it.
She moves her finger, taps the area that shows the television set hidden underneath the counter. She plays the video back and forth, and on the screen within the screen there are faint images of a man and two women arguing, and then one woman pushing the man into an in-ground swimming pool.
That, York says. See that?
Nobody says anything, and from the look in their eyes, they don't have to.
Anybody recognize the program? She asks.
Again, silence. York takes a deep breath.
It's one of those reality television shows. This one is on Bravo. It follows a group of rich and spoiled housewives. This particular episode ends with a fight between two women, with one woman pushing the other's husband into the pool. I went back online, checked the local television listings, and found out when it was aired in this area. Guys, the timestamp's been played with. The episode showing that fight scene was at 6:40 p.m. last Wednesday night, not at 7:40. The Rangers, maybe they were leaving to go visit that house, maybe even break the arms of the drug dealer. But the timing is off. And somebody did it on purpose.
She waits. She runs the video once again and the four men lean in. She warms inside when Cook says, "My apologies. You did one hell of a good job." And he quickly changes the subject. Sanchez?
Sir,
he says. You got into that dog owner's house with your usual bag of tricks, correct?
Yes, sir, I did. No excuse.
None needed, Cook says. Get back into that bag of tricks. I know what you carry based on our last trip to Germany. Go on back to all of our rooms, especially room 11. Tell me if you locate any ears or eyes.
On it, sir,
he says, and he goes over to the other rental car. Opens the trunk, moves things around for a minute or two, and then quickly walks back to the row of doors, holding in his right hand a small black box that has two stubby antennas. Even in the heat, York feels frozen, Just a minute ago, it seemed like everything was done, finished. Her and the crew heading back to Quantico in humiliation and disgrace. Her army career crippled. Being called home, following orders, nothing else to do. Now? This pure mystery of whether or not the four Army Rangers murdered a house full of civilians last week has now grown darker, more complex, and more dangerous, no doubt about it. Sanchez comes back, takes one more look at his device.
"Confirmed, Major," he says. "We've got GSM listening devices in each room and two in room 11, our workroom."
"No doubt about it. We've been spied on since we got here." Chapter 43. While Sanchez was doing his work, I was already deciding what was going to happen next. Again, my squad is looking at me, seeking answers, seeking direction. I'm not going to disappoint them. "Decision time," I say. "Lieutenant Colonel Broderick has ordered us to shut down. He also told me he wanted to know about our travel plans by noon today. That's in about 6 hours. I pause for a moment and continue. "You're going to continue talking and discussing in all of the rooms like normal. You're not going to set any traps or talk for 20 minutes about the weather. Nothing that will raise suspicions. But make sure you don't reveal exact times or places where you might be going. And that includes the interior of the rentals. Those might be bugged as well. They just may have GPS surveillance trackers stuck to the undercarriages. Sanchez, check them out." Sanchez nods. Huang says,
"But what's the point, if we're supposed to leave in 6 hours?
I shake my head. "No, you didn't hear me right, Lieutenant. I'm supposed to tell Colonel Broderick of our travel plans by noon. Not anything else." Again, a moment of silence. I say, "This is where it's going to get interesting, gentlemen. And lady. You know what's ahead for all of you. You can retire to your rooms and take the rest of the day off. That might be the right choice. Or you can keep on working this case, whatever the hell it is." Sanchez from the LAPD is the first.
"I'm in, boss."
"Me too,"
comes Huang, the psychiatrist, followed by Pierce, the attorney, who says, "You can't keep me away from this one."
Connie nods. "We've just broken something here, with the listening devices and doctored surveillance tape, the CIA involvement. This lady's not for turning."
I'm surprised at how quickly overwhelmed I am at seeing this diverse group of army folks come together so easily, right after I chewed out their collective asses. I'm not sure if they know exactly the career black holes they've committed themselves to entering, but I'm so damn proud of them that I can't talk for a moment. I cough. "All right. A few more items on the to-do list. Connie, you go back to that convenience store, and you grill that owner, you grill him hard, about what happened to that tape. Who was behind it and why? Sanchez, I know that house belongs to a hoarder, but like I said before, I want you to go in and find something to lead you to where she is, all right? Find something. Then I want you and York to get back to that funeral home. See if the family of Stuart Pike has called to make arrangements. I don't know how you're going to do it, but I want you to grab that body for a future autopsy by someone who doesn't run a funeral home. I want to know more about when his wrists were broken, and how. It seems like the Rangers did it on purpose. Let's make sure. About 10 minutes ago, this group was low-key, dispirited, unsure of what to do next. I'm happy to see fire in their respective eyes. That's not all, I say. Lieutenant Huang, you're going back to the jail. I want another conversation with the three surviving Rangers. Quietly, my doctor says,
I don't know if they're going to want to talk to me.
Then find out, I say. Do your job. For all you know, one of those Rangers might be shook up by Tyler's suicide. And I want Captain Pierce to go along as well. Again, see if you can find out why they're insisting on no representation. What in the hell is driving them?
Sir, Pierce says.
Finally, I say, Sanchez and York, I want you to go back to the summer house. Supposedly there are listening devices in there, ones that recorded the dynamic entry, the shooting, and those last words about not screwing around with a Ranger's family. All of that was fed to us. I want some evidence that the house was really bugged, got it? More nods around the half circle of my brave folks.
Sir?
Huang asks.
Yes?
Are you going to call Colonel Broderick at noon then?
I smile.
I'm afraid not.
My crew looks puzzled.
I go on. By noon, I plan to be on my way to Afghanistan.
Chapter 44. Special Agent Connie York is shocked by what she's just heard and says, "Major, Afghanistan?"
"That's right," he says. "The Rangers being over there, their deployment being cut short, them being accused of committing the same crime in Afghanistan as they supposedly committed here in Georgia last week. That's where it all began. It needs to be looked into. And that's why I'm going."
"But..." York stops what she's about to say, knowing it's going to sound foolish out here in this dark parking lot with the other investigators around her.
"Go on," Cook says. "What were you going to say?"
"Sir, you've always said you would never, ever go back to Afghanistan."
The major just nods. "I have said that, haven't I? Good memory. Things change, don't they? All right, any other questions, concerns? Connie, you're going to drive me off to Hunter Army Airfield in 15 minutes. I'm going to try to grab a flight from there."
She says, "Yes, sir. Good luck."
"It's up to the Army and my convincing skills. Not sure if luck is going to be a factor. But Agent York and everyone else, pay attention." His confident words just flow right out and nearly shake her to the core. "While I'm in transit, I'm going to be in and out of contact for a couple of days," he says. "In my absence, Agent York is in command. Questions?" And damn him, there is a question from Sanchez. He steps forward, tattooed biceps prominent and bold, and he says, "Sir, if I may, no disrespect to Agent York, but I have more street experience and—" "Shut it," Cook says. "Anything else?" Silence. So quiet, York can hear the flying bugs bounce against the closest streetlight. "Get to work," he says, and he limps back to his room. Sanchez catches her eye, and she wonders if he's going to apologize, but he turns and goes back to his room. Just over an hour later, York pulls the rental Ford into the parking lot of the 4th Ranger Battalion headquarters building. Dawn broke just a few minutes ago, but the base is already busy with vehicle and pedestrian traffic. Here, the parking lot is nearly empty. The battalion is now overseas, Iraq or Afghanistan, checking their gear, loading weapons, ready to move out and act on their training to be the tip of the proverbial spear. York says, "Are you sure, Major?" "No choice," he says, dressed casually in khaki slacks and a short leather jacket, his metal cane at his side. "It started in Afghanistan. We need to find out what and how it started."
"No, I meant..."
"You mean, why did I put you in command?" he asks. "Don't insult me and don't insult yourself. Anything else?"
"Sat phone?"
"In my bag," he says. "I'll be out of touch here and there for the next day or two. It's going to be yours. You heard what I said back at the motel. Follow through hard, but be flexible. Whatever new leads you develop, they're yours. But work quickly. You probably have 24 hours before Quantico comes down and crushes you."
"Nice thoughts," York says.
"You seem pretty calm, considering your career will probably be over by the end of this week." York knows those words should freeze her with fear, but instead she feels almost exhilarated, knowing she is on a knife edge. She thinks maybe this is what the Rangers over in that building felt like, going into combat. Everything exposed, everything on the line.
"The only thing I'm concerned about is that we're all out here, alone," she says. "No support from the locals and definitely no support from Quantico. It feels like we're the Light Brigade, charging out all alone with cannon fire roaring at us."
Cook passes his room key over and says, "Go through the trash in my room."
"What?"
he says. "There's a piece of paper, a note, from a local newspaper reporter, Peggy something or other. She wants an interview. Talk to her. She'll be your local intelligence agency. Find out if she has anything to offer. When I get a chance to call, I will."
Cook gets out, shuts the door, and then opens the rear door and grabs a black knapsack. He starts limping to the front door of the battalion building. Something both warm and cold seems to settle into her chest. York knows she should get to work, but she can't take her eyes off her handsome and struggling boss, limping like he has the entire hopes and fears of the squad riding on his shoulders. The major opens the front door, walks in, disappears from sight. Connie sighs, starts up the Ford's engine, and then jumps with fear as the passenger door opens up and a soldier gets in and sits down.
"How's it going, Agent York?"
asks Colonel Tringali, head of the base's 3rd MP group. Chapter 45. Special Agent Manuel Sanchez is back at the home of Wendy Gabriel, famed dog walker.
"Wendy," he calls out. "Toby, hello?"
No answer, but once he expertly picks the lock, he still enters the house with his Sig Sauer pistol out in a two-handed grip just in case. He blinks his eyes. The stench is burning them. The voice from the major returns to him. "Find something." The search is slow, methodical, and sickening. In the living room 33 minutes ago, seeing handwriting on a thick manila envelope hidden underneath two old copies of Glamour magazine, he picked up the envelope and opened it, revealing plastic-wrapped stool samples from Toby from a month ago. That led to a vomiting match out on the porch, soiling his Brooks Brothers jacket, and he has a foul thought of that ice queen, Connie York, being in charge of the unit while the major is in Afghanistan. Sure, according to the record, she is senior to him by about 2 months, but based on his street experience, he should be running this case, not her. Now he's up on the second floor, head light, guts sour, and feeling like he needs an hour-long shower, wishing he could burn his clothes, save for his jacket, when this is done. But he won't give up. Not with the major flying over the Atlantic toward a place so filled with horrors he swore he would never return there. Sanchez spends just a few minutes in the bathroom, wishing for the light blue latex gloves he had back in the LAPD, but he finds nothing but old cosmetics and prescription bottles. From there, he goes into the bedroom, follows the same cluttered path leading to the unmade bed, sees two impressions in the stained, crumpled sheet, one smeared with dog hair and what looks to be dog spit. Wonderful. Sanchez turns, follows a narrower path cleared through the waist-high piles of junk to the bureau at the other end of the room, the top of it clean save for some sheets of paper.
"Idiota," he whispers.
Here, at least, are some things Wendy likes to keep ordered. Recent bills from Georgia Power, Comcast, and AT&T. Envelopes in a neat pile with handwriting noting, "Paid 824, check number 1119. One other envelope is apart from the others, cream-colored and thicker. The typewritten address is Wendy's, and the return address is an embossed blue seal and a Sullivan District Attorney. Sanchez opens the envelope, reads the message on a nice thick piece of office stationery, whereupon one Wendy Gabriel of Sullivan, in and of Sullivan County, is charged with numerous violations of Georgia Code 16-12-4. Cruelty to animals, said complaint brought to the district attorney's office by. He quickly folds the sheet of paper, returns it to the envelope, and puts it in his jacket pocket just when his cell phone rings. Chapter 46. For the last 40 seconds, Captain Rory O'Connell's stare at me has been steady and unyielding.
"Lucky you,"
he finally whispers.
"We do have a C-17 Globemaster taking off within 30 minutes. End destination Bagram, carrying additional equipment, but why in hell should I allow you to get onto that aircraft?"
"I need to get to Afghanistan," I say.
"Why?"
"I'm convinced there's evidence over there concerning the Rangers from Alpha Company."
"What kind of evidence?"
"I don't know," I say.
"All right," O'Connell says. "Do you have orders from your superiors in Quantico?"
"No."
"Travel authorizations?"
"No."
"Have you had a recent medical exam and immunization update?"
"No." The 4th Battalion's rear detachment commander waits another long second.
"I don't see a helmet, body armor, gas mask, or anything else you need for an overseas deployment, Major."
"I'm hoping you'll help me out." O'Connell shakes his head, leans back a bit in his chair, and I see him wince from his old injuries.
"Major, why in God's name would I even consider letting you on that aircraft? No orders, no authorization, no equipment? What, you think this is an episode of NCIS you can just hitch a ride into a combat zone? It's a career ender for both of us. Now please, leave me be. 4th Battalion's XO is still not available, there's a missing pallet of equipment that should be in Bagram, and I've got a shitload of paperwork to get through, all because someone decided 4th Battalion needed to be deployed nearly a month ahead of schedule.
I lean on my cane. You don't like the ninja squad, do you?
Not many around here do.
But if you were in an FOB with them, with Taliban coming at you in waves, and they were next to you and they were running low on ammo, you'd help them out, right? Even if you don't like them. Out there, you'd have their backs, and vice versa.
O'Connell's face winces once more. That's different. That's over there, not here in Georgia.
I limp toward him. That's where you're wrong, Captain. Something happened to them in Afghanistan, and it's followed them to Georgia. That's what I'm trying to tell you. Afghanistan has come home here to Georgia, and those guys are low on ammo and need your help.
I hear a distant whine of jet engines. Wonder if that's the C-17 ready to take off and make the long flight to Afghanistan, the dusty and torn up country that has sent so many of our finest back home in shiny metal caskets. O'Connell looks down, picks up a pen, and in one harsh move, tosses it across the small office. He gets up. Follow me, he says. And even with that cane, haul ass. Nearly 30 minutes later, I'm practically stumbling across the flight line, leaning heavily on my cane, wearing freshly washed ACUs tagged cook, and carrying one heavy rucksack with a helmet bouncing along against my hip. Helicopters and other aircraft are lined up in neat rows before us. The engine noise gets louder as we approach the C-17 Globemaster, dark green, squat, fat and ugly, with four engines slung underneath its large wings. And O'Connell leans close and yells, It's about 13 hours to Ramstein, and from there, another 7 or so to Bagram. There's no first class or business class seats aboard, Major, just the fold-down seats along the fuselage. Going to be damn uncomfortable.
I'll make do, I say, knowing there's nothing else I can say.
He says, Not sure where the 4th Battalion is going to be deployed. Orders change all the time. But you'll want to get transport from Bagram to the village of Pendahar. That's near where the event happened with the ninjas.
Got it, I say.
It's the old west in the Middle East, Indian country out there, he says. So watch your ass and do your best to hook up with anybody that's got heavy firepower. And no offense, that sure as hell ain't the CID.
I just nod, knowing that I have nearly 20 hours of flying time ahead of me to think of where I'm going and what I'll do when I get there. He grabs my elbow.
You sure you can do this, limping like you do?
The engine noise is louder.
I've got to.
He says,
That IED, what happened to you over there?
Usual story, I tell him, raising my voice. Was out on a mission, 3-vehicle convoy, we got hit. I was trapped in the wreckage. Took a while for me to get pried out. O'Connell tries to smile.
Hope it was an important mission.
Sure was, I say. I was going out to interview a goat herder whose flock was raided by an airborne unit for a cookout. He shakes his head and I can tell his own pain is really riding him today. Then he laughs.
Thanks for your service, Major.
And you? I ask. Looks like you're still carrying a bit of shrapnel in you.
Nope, he says. Not a single piece of metal.
I'm sure he notes the confusion on my face and he adds,
Oh, I was wounded when that mortar round struck my FOB. But I wasn't injured by that. Our interpreter, Nadir, he took the full force of the blast, pulverized him, and I was nearly shredded into pieces by his bone fragments.
He slaps me on the shoulder.
Get going or you'll miss your flight.
I don't tell the captain that despite my brave front, that's exactly what I want to do. Instead, I take a breath and go forward to the large aircraft that's returning me to a deadly nightmare. Off by the airfield service buildings, I see the flashing blue lights of MP cruisers. I try to pick up my pace, ignoring the MP arrival back there, and move right along to what's ahead for me.
Chapter 47. The cell phone belonging to Special Agent Connie York begins ringing and she ignores it as Colonel Tringali gives her a steady look.
Good morning, Colonel, she says. Agent York, comes the calm reply. Looks like your major is going off on a trip.
I wouldn't say that, she says, thinking.
Not sure what's going on, but I can't let you delay the major.
Her cell phone stops ringing. The colonel says,
Not bothering to answer it?
Not at the moment, ma'am.
A few seconds drag by. Where's Major Cook going?
Tringali asks.
Into 4th Battalion headquarters, ma'am.
I can see that, she says sharply. Who's he going to see in there?
I would imagine someone from the 4th Battalion, ma'am.
Considering 99% of 4th Battalion is now overseas, that doesn't leave very many possibilities, does it now? Tringali says.
Your major is seeing Captain O'Connell, the rear detachment commander.
That sounds like a good guess, ma'am, Connie says, and her cell phone starts ringing again. Months ago, she selected a standard old-fashioned ringtone for this new handheld and is glad for the solid choice.
Still not going to answer your phone?
It would be rude, ma'am, she says.
Why did your major go see Captain O'Connell carrying a knapsack? The colonel asks.
Caught, she thinks, caught.
All it would take would be this hard-ass MP officer going in and mucking things up. But what can she say?
Stall.
She says, The major likes to be prepared.
The cell phone stops ringing.
Tringali says, If he's so goddamn prepared, that must be the same for his little squad of investigators. Right? Tell me, Special Agent, does the name Wendell Connor ring a bell?
Colonel Wendell Connor?
Damn it, the name does sound vaguely familiar, but before Connie can think further, Tringali says, Colonel Connor is the goddamn garrison commander of this post. Tradition and common courtesy would mean your major should have at least met with him to brief him on this investigation.
I can't speak for the major, ma'am, she says.
Certainly, Tringali replies. But that's how you've operated. Outside normal rules, regulations, and procedures. Just like the goddamn ninja squad you're so eager to clear. But a little birdie from Quantico told me that you and the rest of your squad are being called back and are going to be disbanded. Nothing can save you folks now. You've crossed a lot of lines. Just like those Rangers. They've crossed the line and nobody, not even you and your precious major, can save them.
Tringali opens the door, steps out and turns around, putting her hands on the roof of the Ford rental and lowering her head to look back inside, just as Connie's cell phone rings once more.
How long will your major be in there?
Just long enough, she thinks.
I don't know, ma'am. He seems to be a capable fellow, am I right? Able to hitch a ride back to Sullivan when he's done? Sorry, ma'am, I don't understand, she says.
Then understand this. Get your ass off my post and don't ever come back. And answer that goddamn phone already. Chapter 48. Captain Alan Pierce is sitting in the front seat of their Ford rental, with Lieutenant John Huang sitting next to him, silent, parked on a side road underneath the shade of two old oak trees. Earlier they spent a rotten hour at the Ralston Town Jail being harassed by the news media, then yelled at and threatened with arrest by tomato-faced Chief Richard Kane. Pierce says, Rough morning, am I right? Huang softly says,
Not as rough as yesterday.
Sure, Pierce thinks, when Specialist Tyler slit his wrists and bled out all over his concrete cell floor. He says, Doc, again, it wasn't your fault. You were doing your job. That's it. Huang sits up and looks at Pierce with something Pierce has never seen from the doctor before. Pure anger.
Shut up, will you? Captain? Look, if you screw up, that means a defendant is having a bad day. Maybe he goes away to Leavenworth until an appeal is made. Or you do something wrong in court, and maybe a guy as guilty as sin walks free. But you know what? They're still goddamn alive, aren't they?
I screw up, a decorated and brave man opens up his veins and bleeds out in a small Georgia town.
His choice, Doc, not yours.
What kind of doctor was I then? Was I doing the best I could for him as a patient? No, I was doing what was best for the Army.
In case you've forgotten, you're an Army officer, John. He shakes his head in disgust, plucks at his trousers.
Me? An officer? I'm just a goddamn underpaid psychiatrist who's never heard a shot fired in anger. Has used his service weapon 4 times, all at the range, and I can't remember the last time I wore my dress uniform.
Pierce doesn't know what to say. He hates to admit it, but Huang is making a good point. He remembers the initial shock of going through the 6-week direct commission course at Fort Benning, in this very state, and the tough trial of transferring from a civilian life to a military life. There, the slogan was, "Soldier first, army always." But Huang is right. What kind of soldier is he compared to the Rangers? What can Pierce say to convince Huang that he is a soldier, that he was doing his job? He takes his cell phone out, dials Sanchez, and Sanchez answers on the first ring. Pierce says, "How goes it?" "I've wrapped up at this woman's place. Is Agent York with you?" "I've called her 3 times, no answer. She must still be at Hunter." Sanchez says, "Look, the major told York and me to hit the funeral home, try to grab that kid's body for a real autopsy. With her out of reach, I'm going over there in a few minutes, and I could use you as a backup, find some legal way for us to grab the remains." Pierce says, "What legal way?" Sanchez says, "You're the damn lawyer in this group. Find one." He says, "All right, I'll meet you there. And the doc is coming with me as well. We're not getting any cooperation from the Ralston police chief to see the other Rangers." "Fine by me," Sanchez says. "Maybe he can counsel the funeral home director to cooperate with us. See you in a bit." "Hey," Pierce says, "you say you're done at that woman's house. Did you find something?" "I sure as hell did," Sanchez says, and disconnects the call. Chapter 49. Inside his cell at the Ralston Town Jail, Staff Sergeant Caleb Jefferson is sitting cross-legged on his bunk, waiting, thinking, pondering. There's a fresh smell of soap and bleach in the air, and he knows it's from yesterday, from cleaning up the adjacent cell after Specialist Vinnie Tyler, his man, his responsibility, ended his life. A good leader always takes care of his men, always brings them back the best he can, and he feels bone deep inside that he's a failure. Not that he hasn't lost men before, but that was overseas in the stand where a sniper's bullet, a mortar round, or an RPG could end a life in the blink of an eye. That was the job. That was the risk everyone took. But not here. Not in this pissy little cell, not in Georgia. Colonel Barnes whispers, "How are you doing, Sergeant?" "Shut up," Jefferson says. The other surviving member of their squad pipes up as well.
"Sergeant, we all agreed about what happened. Vinny, he just couldn't hack it anymore, that's all. It's not your fault."
"Ruiz?"
"Yes?"
"You can shut up too." They quiet down. He continues to sit, brooding. Out there is his other responsibility. His stepdaughter, Carol, though truthfully, he never really uses the word step. The two of them bonded almost instantly when he started seeing her mother, Janice, with none of the fighting and griping about, "You're not my real daddy." And she was his daughter as much as any biological father's out there. He wonders how she is. He wonders about Major Moore, the battalion's XO, if he got to Aunt Sophie in time. The planning, the agreements, everything else must stay in place. Jefferson realizes he's clenching his fists. But what if he's wrong? And what if all this ends up killing the last 2 members of his squad? Chapter 50. She can't see Hunter Army Airfield, but the noise of the aircraft taking off and landing can be heard just beyond the thick grove of pines and messy swamp. Mosquitoes fly around her in clouds, and after a minute she gets back into her civilian car, waits, slapping and killing 2 of the little monsters that got into the car with her. Today she has on her uniform, and it feels good. Even though it's nice to get into civvy clothes when one's shift is done, it's also nice to wear the uniform and to have people look at it, connect her to a powerful organization, and for the most part give her the respect and attention she deserves. She checks the time just as her burner phone chimes. Right on schedule. "Yes," she answers. Again, there's a burst of static and a harsh whine, and the caller's familiar voice comes on and says, "Tell me what's new." "The investigation has been officially closed," she says. "They've been ordered to wrap up and go back to Quantico. Within a day, everything here will calm down. The army can screw up here and there, but one thing they're good at is following orders." Even with the bad connection in the distance, she can sense the relief in the man's voice. "Good news indeed. Finally, Jesus." She shakes her head, not happy she has to spoil his good mood. "But there's a complication," she says. "Cook is on his way to Afghanistan.
Somehow he found out what happened to the Rangers over there.
Her desperate man swears for a long minute, and he says with more bursts of static interrupting him,
"Never should have trusted you. Gone along with this scheme. Damn it, we're both going down."
She says, "Shut up and listen good. We both agree to this, and we're both going to see it through. It's going to take Cook nearly a day to get over there. Lots of time for me to continue cleaning things up on this end. And when he gets there, it's going to be one crippled CID officer with no orders, no backup, in a combat zone. Lots of bad things can happen to him."
Hiss of static. "Like what?" he says.
"Like never you mind," she says. "But things are getting more complicated. No more calls, just see it through. In a few more days, it will be fine. Trust me."
The signal wavers some, and then the call is over.
Damn him, she thinks. What creature has she hooked her wagon to anyway?
She gets out of the car, takes the burner phone apart as before, breaking the SIM card, and she scoops out some mud with her dress boot and buries the phone in pieces. Then she hears the sound of a vehicle approaching. From the narrow dirt road behind her, a mud-spattered black Jeep with a black canvas top grinds up through the brush, engine rumbling. On the front bumper, a faded sticker is barely visible, showing the bars and stars and the words, "The South Shall Rise Again." Two men get out of the Jeep, bearded, wearing worn jeans and hooded sweatshirts.
"Hey, sweetie," the one on the right says, grinning. "How's about moving your crap car so we can get by? Huey and me are in the mood for some four-wheeling."
She says, "I was here first. Why don't you back up and let me get by?"
The two men laugh. The other man says, "Shit, sweetie, you think that uniform impresses us? You're out of your jurisdiction, hon. So why don't you move your hunk of junk so we can push on by?" The driver says, "Yeah, I don't reverse for no one, and especially some broad who thinks she's all that."
She nods. "All right," she says. "I was just trying to be nice." Her pistol slides easily right out of her holster, and she shoots them both in the head.
Chapter 51. Special Agent Manuel Sanchez is sitting alone inside his rental car in the parking lot of Briggs Brothers' funeral home and spots another silver Ford sedan pull up next to him. Sanchez gets out, walks over, and opens the rear door, taking a seat. Pierce and Huang are sitting up front. The interior of the car stinks of sweat and well-worn clothes. Sanchez shuts the door. "Any word from the Ice Queen?" Pierce's hands are draped over the steering wheel. "I don't like that nickname." "Tough," Sanchez says. Huang says, "We got a text from her a while ago. Seems like the Major got himself a flight out of Hunter to Bagram. York's on her way back to meet us here. You find anything over at the dog walker's house?"
"I did," he says.
Pierce says, "What did you find?"
Sanchez says, "Since York is now in command of this little detachment, I'll wait until she gets here. I don't want her to get upset that I'm going behind her back."
Huang shakes his head. "She's been a warrant officer longer than you. Cook put her in charge. What's your problem?"
Sanchez says, "I know things. I've seen things. Especially when an inexperienced woman takes charge and people get hurt or killed. I don't mind women being in charge, only if they've got the background. York doesn't have it. She's been a state trooper traveling the mean streets of the Beltway, and," Pierce says, "here she is." Sanchez sees the Ford with the battered and scraped hood pull in next to them, and Pierce says, "John, you know you don't have to come in here." Huang doesn't wait.
"Captain, I'm coming in."
Sanchez joins the JAG lawyer and the psychiatrist outside as York emerges from her own rental. She looks worn, tired, overwhelmed. "Good," he thinks. "Maybe later the two of them can have a come-to-Jesus meeting and she'll do what's right for the good of the group, letting him take the lead."
York says, "The Major is on his way to Bagram, best as I can tell. After I dropped him off, I had a brief talk with Colonel Tringali, the head of the MP unit at Hunter. She knows we've been ordered to head back to Quantico. And if she knows, the word will get back to Virginia that we're not currently packing our bags. We don't have much time." Sanchez says, "Connie, it's Agent York, if you please," she says. "What is it? We don't have time to dick around."
He feels his jaw tense. "Nothing, ma'am. He can wait."
"Good," she says. Let's see what we can get from Mr. Briggs. Pierce, you got some legal mumbo-jumbo that will allow us to grab Stuart Pike's body?
I think so, he says, rubbing at the stubble on his chin. None of the men had time to shave this morning, and Sanchez is still steaming over York's put-down.
All right, let's do this. Huang, you can stick behind if you want.
He manages a smile.
Strength in numbers, ma'am. Maybe we'll scare him straight or something.
Maybe, she says.
With each passing second, each passing minute, York is aware that Major Cook is farther out there over the Atlantic Ocean, heading into a combat zone, while she's taking command in a little combat zone of her own. Not only does she have to deal with an angry Army MP colonel who wants to see the three surviving Rangers have a date with an executioner's needle, she also has somebody who's bugged their rooms and one CID investigator who's being a royal pain in the ass. After brushing past the younger Mr. Briggs, she and the other are in the director's office. Ferguson Briggs looks the same as he did the other day, save the knee-length white smock he previously wore over his black suit, and his dark brown basset hound eyes look surprised at seeing his office crowded with four Army personnel. York is sitting in one leather-upholstered chair, Sanchez is sitting next to her, and Pierce and Huang are against the near wall. Hidden speakers air soft classical music. The place is carpeted, somber, with unread leather-bound books in a bookcase. One wall holds a display of casket styles, complete with finishes and handles, and various framed certificates hang opposite. Briggs's desk is neat and orderly, with file folders and a thick black binder Connie thinks must contain the pricing options he shows the grieving. About the only object out of place is a plain brown cardboard box, tied together with string. And speaking of grieving families, Briggs gets right to the point.
I'm sorry, ma'am, but you've come at a very bad time, he says. I have the Parnell family arriving in a few minutes. You need to be out of my office by then. You see, their poor son died last night in their garage.
Suicide? Connie asks.
In a manner of speaking, he says. The young lad died of an overdose, like so many others in this county. One of the hardest parts will be writing the obituary. We often say died suddenly at home, but most folks know what that means nowadays. Now again, tell me why you're here.
The bodies of the victims, she says. We'd like to examine them again.
And grab one on our way out, she thinks, until we can figure out what to do next.
I'm sorry, but all save one have been turned over to their respective families.
Sanchez butts in.
For real? Why so soon?
Briggs still looks mournful.
Why not? With regard to the bodies, the county sheriff has told us her investigation is complete. She authorized me to release the remains. The last family left about 30 minutes ago, the Gleason boy.
Connie says,
hold on, you said all save one. Who's left?
The poor gent who had his arms broken, Briggs says. Arrangements for his remains are still up in the air.
That's good, Connie says. Because our investigation isn't complete, and we'd like to view him again.
No need to mention taking Pike. She trusts Pierce, the JAG lawyer, has a strategy to use when the right time comes.
All right, I suppose you can do that, for all the good it will do you.
A little shiver of cold caresses the back of Connie's neck.
I'm sorry, what do you mean by that?
Briggs points to the cardboard box.
I received directions to cremate his remains, and there they are, waiting to be shipped to Savannah.
The room falls silent. Connie thinks she hears the quick intake of breath from Pierce and Huang. Briggs says,
is there anything else I can do for the Army?
Chapter 52. Speeding into the parking lot of Route 119 Gas and Go, Special Agent Connie York nearly runs into a motorcyclist pulling out from the pumps. A woman with a helmet and leathers flipping her the bird as she roars out onto the state road, and Connie thinks, sure, why not? One more piece of bad luck to maintain the tone of her day. She pulls into an empty space, and the second Ford, driven by Sanchez, who was determined to tailgate her all the way over here, pulls in next to her. Then Huang parks in the third rental car. Beside her in the car, Pierce says, don't let Manuel get you down.
I won't,
she says, taking the keys out of the ignition.
But when I get a chance, either later this week or during our respective disciplinary hearings, I plan to ring his bell.
You do that, you'll get free representation from me.
York gets out, Sanchez and Huang exit their cars, and they all go into the convenience store, thankfully empty of customers. Behind the counter is an older Indian man with a thick mustache and bright eyes and a big smile, wearing gray slacks and a pink polo shirt with the store logo. He says, "Good day, ma'am," as York goes up to the counter.
"Good day to you," she says. "Where's Mr. Ligari?"
He looks at each of them.
"Good day to all of you,"
York says.
"Yes, thanks for your courtesy. Where is Mr. Ligari?"
A nod.
"Help you?"
"Vihan Ligari, where is he?"
The man keeps smiling.
"Can I help?"
he says. Sanchez says,
"Looks like we've got a language problem here, boss."
She swears to herself and then sees a photo of the owner in a frame nearby, along with a woman and his two children.
"Here,"
she says, picking up the photo, holding it in front of the man.
"Where are they?"
She motions to the rear of the store and then outside, and the man vigorously nods.
"Ah, Vihan, he's gone."
"Gone where?"
"Gone home," the man says, still smiling. "To Mumbai."
Huang says,
"The store owner leaves with his family, and there's one guy left behind. Doesn't sound good, boss."
Then Sanchez moves in next to her, flashes his leather wallet with his CID badge, and says,
"Police, got that? Police?"
The man isn't smiling anymore, and York says,
"Sanchez, what the hell are you doing?"
"My job," he shoots back. "You should try it sometime."
Not fair, but Sanchez thinks of the times back in the LAPD when he came up against people like this clerk who smiled a lot and pretended to know just a few words of English. More than 200 languages are spoken in his home state of California, and in investigating cases, Sanchez has run into everything from Albanian to Urdu and has no patience to wait for an interpreter. He goes around the counter, still holding his badge out like he's facing a vampire with a cross, and the guy shuffles back, lifts up his hands, and York says,
"Knock it off, Sanchez. Get your ass back over here."
Pierce says, "Whatever you're doing, Sanchez, it's illegal and it won't be admissible in any court." And crap, even Huang jumps in and says,
"If your intent is scaring a guy who can't speak English well, congratulations, you're doing a great job."
He ignores them all, sees a pile of receipts, invoices, and other paperwork. All in English, thank you very much, and he starts flipping through the yellow and pink invoices, the other bills from snack suppliers and soft drink distributors, and yes, yes, right there. Buried deep in the pile, another envelope with the return address of Sullivan District Attorney. The clerk says something in Hindi or whatever, and Sanchez gives him a look, sees the cheery smile and happy face are gone, and there's the look of one hard man who would probably take him on if there weren't other people in the store. He pulls out the sheet of paper within the envelope, gives it a quick glance. The language is almost identical to what he read back in Wendy Gabriel's House of Trash and Smells. Vihan Ligari, DBA Route 119 Gas and Go of Sullivan, in and of Sullivan County, is charged with numerous violations of Georgia Code 3323. Furnishing to, purchase of, or possession by persons under 21 years of age of alcoholic beverages. Use of false identification. Proper identification. Dispensing, serving, selling, or handling by persons under 21 years of age in the course of employment. Seller's actions upon receiving false identification, said complaint brought to the district attorney's office by. Sanchez takes the envelope from his coat pocket that he lifted from the top of Wendy Gabriel's bureau, pulls out that sheet of paper, turns and holds them both up so Pierce, Swang, and especially York can see them.
"See this?" he says, thrusting out his left hand. "Criminal complaint filed against Wendy Gabriel from the district attorney, charging her with cruelty to animals."
And he puts out his right hand.
"And this? Criminal complaint filed against this store and its owner for selling alcohol to minors. Maybe Pierce can tell us later the punishments, but I bet the animal cruelty one would mean the woman's dog being seized. And here? The store's liquor license being pulled, which is just as good as shutting it down."
Sanchez folds up both sheets of paper, returns them to their respective envelopes. He says,
"Agent York, both complaints were brought forth by Sheriff Emma Williams. Get it? And if she's put you at risk for losing what's precious to you, what would you do to prevent that?"
Huang says,
"Good God, you'd do anything, anything at all."
Sanchez nods, feeling great, feeling on top of the world.
like cooperating in putting out false evidence, he says. Chapter 53. Special Agent Connie York is pushing the damaged Ford rental up Route 119 as fast as she can, with the dented and scraped front hood shaking and vibrating like it's seconds away from tearing off. She feels like she's in a race for her life, for justice, for everything, and some damnable folks are up ahead, pulling the finish line away from her. Next to her, Pierce, the squad's JAG attorney, gets off his smartphone and says, "No joy, Connie. District Attorney Slate is in meetings all day. Can't be disturbed." "Big surprise," she says, looking up in the rearview mirror, seeing the other two rentals in a train right behind her, Sanchez hanging close again with Huang not far behind. "All right, get on the phone with Briggs, the funeral home director, and put him on speaker." She checks the time as Pierce starts making the call. At this point, Major Cook is still hours short of arriving in Germany for a refueling stop, and even with the satellite phone, is probably out of reach. No matter. She's seeing this one through.
"All right, sir, hold on, please. I'm going to put you on speakerphone," Pierce says.
A flick of the finger on the screen and a voice booms out.
"This is Ferguson Briggs."
"Mr. Briggs, thank you," Connie says, keeping her eye on the narrow state road. "A quick question, if I may. This morning you said something to the effect that you received directions to cremate the remains of Stuart Pike, the man who had been renting that home." Briggs says nothing for a moment, and then cautiously he says,
"Yes, that's true. I did receive instructions to do that."
"From his family?"
"No,"
he says.
"Who, then?"
Another pause, and she glances at Pierce, who glances right back at her with a look of expectation upon his face. Briggs clears his throat.
"Why, Sheriff Williams contacted me and told me to go ahead with the cremation. She told me that a family member had contacted her."
"You just went ahead and did it, then?" Connie asks.
"Why not?"
Connie makes a chopping motion with her right hand, and Pierce disconnects the phone call. Up ahead is the now familiar dirt road off to the right, leading to the summer house. She makes the turn, speeding right by the old sign, the other Fords following behind her. And then she sees a haze, some parked vehicles with flashing lights, and when the smell of something burning comes to her, she knows once again she's too late. York slows down and approaches the house as Pierce says, "Oh shit, look at that." On the scene are two brown and white cruisers from the Sullivan County Sheriff's Department and two fire engines from the town's volunteer fire department. About a half dozen firefighters wearing bright yellow turnout gear and helmets are wetting down what's left of the house, which is a smoldering, smoking pile of collapsed wood, shingles, and broken windows. She parks the rental behind the nearest cruiser and steps out, the smell of smoke thick and disappointing. Even with Pierce next to her and quickly followed by Huang and Sanchez, never has she felt so utterly alone. Even doing traffic stops along the highways of Virginia, back in her state trooper days, she was never entirely by herself if something went south. If she got into something desperate or dangerous back then, help was one quick radio broadcast away. Not here. This entire place is against her and the CID team. Two men and a woman dressed in the brown and tan of the Sullivan County Sheriff's Department are talking to an older man who has Assistant Chief lettered on the back of his coat. And then the woman, Sheriff Williams, of course, breaks away and comes over, a very happy and satisfied smile on her face. Even with the thick Georgia heat, York is taken aback by the confidence in that woman's smile. She's getting away with it, whatever the hell it is, and she's not showing any fear or concern.
"Morning, folks," she says, stepping closer. "Hell of a thing, isn't it? A nice old historical home like this burning down. A real pity."
York shakes her head. "Arson?" A shrug.
"Could be. We'll have to wait for the fire inspectors to figure it out. Might take a month or two."
One by one, the other members of her squad line up next to her, tired, beat down, and now seeing another piece of evidence literally go up in smoke.
"How convenient,"
York says. Sanchez says, "Yeah, damn convenient." Something seems to crackle in the air. The sheriff steps in closer, and her two deputies do the same,
William's face seems to change from the open cheeriness of earlier to something now hard and dark. And then she changes again. Smiles. She reaches out, touches the damaged hood of the Ford.
Wow, will you look at this? Recent collision damage. Looks like you hit something hard.
York keeps quiet. A piece of the shattered roof of the house collapses, causing a flare-up and another billow of smoke. The sheriff says,
You know, funny thing. The other night, Randy Poplar, he runs a private shooting club over on the north side of town, he reported that somebody ran into his pipe gate, dented it all to hell.
The sheriff rubs the hood of the car.
His pipe gate is painted white, and look what we got here. White paint scrapes. Damn coincidence, I'm sure.
I'm sure, York says.
Still, to be certain, I might want to investigate further.
And again her tone changes, becoming slow, threatening.
Seize this vehicle.
Match the paint scrapings here.
Hell, the more I look into this, there might be charges down the road. Know what I mean? Failure to report an accident? Leaving the scene of an accident? Causing an accident resulting in excess of $1,000 in damages. Lots of potential criminal liabilities out there.
The smile pops back.
But Agent York, I hear you folks are being called back to Virginia. Packing up and leaving. Wrapping up your work here. Looks like the only problem you'll have is facing the rental company when you get back to the Savannah airport.
York smiles back.
Sorry, Sheriff, you've heard wrong.
That startles the sheriff. Good.
What did you say?
York says,
You heard wrong. We're not leaving. Not today, not tomorrow. We're leaving when our job is done. No matter what burns down, who disappears, or who flies back to Mumbai, we're staying on this case. If you've forgotten, we're the U.S. Army, and we don't back down.
Williams makes the slightest shake of her head, and the two strong-looking and armed deputies move as one to back her up. The sheriff says,
This county ain't for you.
York heads back to the open door of her car.
Oh, you're wrong, Sheriff,
York says.
I love it here. It's a great, charming place. You know, when I retire, I might even move down here and find a little place to live. Get used to it, Sheriff. My squad and I are going to be here for a long time to come.
Chapter 54. Back at the Route 119 motel and coffee shop, York breaks hard, taking up two spaces and not really giving a shit. The two other sedans pull in and she takes out the key to Major Cook's room, walks in and the place is clean. Fresh linens on the bed, carpet cleaned. His suitcase on the floor next to the door. She goes over to the trash bin, empty as well. She clenches a fist, rubs it against her forehead. What did Major Cook say just before he left? There's a piece of paper, a note, from a local newspaper reporter, Peggy something or other. She wants an interview. Talk to her. She'll be your local intelligence agency. She turns, and Sanchez, Pierce, and Huang are inside the room.
Quick, she says. Anybody know where they dumped the trash for this place?
Huang says,
I went out for a run early yesterday morning. There's a dumpster out behind the coffee shop.
She brushes by them, goes out, and damn it, a herd of reporters is out there with cameras, notepads, pens, and they pepper her with questions as she makes a quick walk to the coffee shop.
Excuse me, do you have any comment on the suicide?
Will the army defend these killers of innocence? Do you think...